Very kind of you. A sower went to sow some seed, and some of the seed fell on the path, but it was hard, and the birds came and ate it up. And some of the seed fell on rocky soil, and it grew up quickly, but the sun baked its roots, and it died for lack of moisture. And some of the seed fell in among the weeds, and it grew up quickly, but the weeds grew up with it and choked it out, and it died. And some of the seed fell on good soil, and it produced fruit, and it bore 30, 60, maybe 100 fold. Bye. Now, I don't know about you. Can I turn this off? This off? Oh, yeah, thanks. If you had a chance to speak to 5,000 people, what would you say? If you're like me, I had a friend of mine ask me this one time, and if you're like me, you would say, well, I want to lay out the whole plan of the Bible and all of salvation and speak to them about how Adam and Eve were created by God and they fell into sin and God promised them a Savior and He came later to Abraham, and Abraham was the father of Isaac, and through Isaac, the father of the Jewish race, from whom the Messiah would come, right? And the Messiah finally came in person of Jesus Christ Himself. He died and was resurrected, and promised that we with Him would live if we trusted in Him. And I'd lay out the whole plan of salvation. And then I would hope that people would come to salvation. I would say, come, if you want to commit yourself to the Lord, raise your hand, or come down front, or something. All of those things are very good things, don't get me wrong, okay? But that's what I would have thought. Now, my question though is, what did Jesus do when He had a chance to speak to 5,000 people? And what He said was, a sower went to sow some seed. And He told that story. If you read Mark, He almost says it out loud, bye, and He leaves. Read it in Mark 4 later on. It says, the disciples chased after Him and said, what does this mean? What are you talking about? And He said, don't you get the parable? Don't you understand? How are you going to understand the kingdom if you don't understand the parables? And He explained it to them. He said, the seed is the Word of God. And the seed that fell among on the hard path here was eaten up by Satan. And you know the rest of the story, right? The seed was lost there. And the shallowness of faith that rises up quickly and then is burned away. And the cares of the world that choke out the life of the seed. And in some places, in good soil, where it actually takes root, it bears fruit. But what He was explaining to them was, I'm not here to lay out the entire plan of salvation when I talk to these 5,000 people. And here's what I want to ask. This is the question I want to ask you, and this is why I'm here this weekend. I want to talk to you about the significance of the arts from a Christian perspective, okay? Taking a Christian worldview and looking at the arts. What does God say about it? Why are we creative people? Why do we paint paintings? Why do we tell stories? Why do we compose music? Why do we conduct music like I do? What is it that we're trying to do? Why do we seem compelled to do that? What part does it play in the life of a Christian? Does it have any part to play? I think you could make the case that when God revealed Himself to us in the Bible, 70% about of that revelation is in story form. The story of Israel, the story of Moses, the story of Joseph, the story of the lives of the prophets like Jonah, and the story of the details of the lives of God's interaction with Isaiah and Jeremiah and so on and so on. There's so much that's told in story. There's also another, say, 15% that is told in poetry, like the Book of Psalms, right? Parables, like I just gave you. Stories and allegories and poetic devices, like similes and songs and poems and so on. You with me? Does that make sense? There is didactic teaching in the Bible. Didactic meaning like, do not lie, do not bear false witness. Okay, that's there. But a lot of times, you learn these things sort of enfleshed in the storyline of what's going on, right? How it is that that God related to the people at the time. Or how he chose to write about himself. For example, Jesus was constantly using metaphors to describe himself to us, right? You know what a metaphor is? What's a metaphor? Who can tell me what a metaphor is? Can you give me a short definition? Yeah? Sort of. She says, when you say where you're describing yourself, is that what you're saying? Where something is part of yourself? It's more than that, yes? Say it a little louder. I'm deaf. I'm not really deaf. I'm just kidding. Yes? That's a good idea. Right? You're comparing two things, right? And you're comparing things that you do understand with something you might be harder to understand, and the comparison helps you do that. That's close. The technical definition, if I remember it right, is that it's the comparison of two things with each other without using the word like or as. Have you heard that definition before? Yeah, that's what a metaphor is. So, when Jesus comes along and says, I am the bread, he's saying, you know bread, right? And we all go, well, duh. Well, I somehow am related to bread. I am like bread. But he's not saying I'm like it. He says, I am it. I am the vine, you are the branches. Those are metaphorical comparisons, right? That's a metaphor. Shakespeare does it. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. There's a metaphor for you. If you think about metaphors, you're always thinking that they spark some sort of comparison, some sort of relationship, and it might be a relationship that you don't get right off. Right? When Romeo says Juliet is the sun, you could sort of unpack that metaphor and get, how would you say it? Juliet's beauty radiates from her face in much the same way that light radiates and heat radiates from the sun. How's that? Not bad? I was teaching a class one time, adult Sunday school class, and I said, now ladies, which of those two would you prefer to have? Juliet is the sun, or that sort of awkward, you know, unpacked, all this stuff? And in the front, this older lady in the front elbowed her husband and she said, I'd take it either way. Yeah, I can relate to that. Okay. But Julie is so concise, and it opens your mind to Romeo's internal thinking, right? And his heart, and so he sees her, and her face is just so beautiful, and he loves her so, and he's just, it's like the moon is second rate compared to this shining face. Okay. Well, when Jesus talks about himself in parable, or in metaphors like that, my question to you is this. If God can do anything he chooses to do in terms of his revelation, if he had several different ways, for example, that he could speak about himself, why did he choose this way? Why did God write the revelation that he wrote the way he did? Now, I think we have to assume that since he's God, and he created language anyway, and after all, he is the Word, right? So he is what language, he's the source of language. That he could have said, let's see, I want to tell them about the relationship between me as their life-giving Lord, and them, their needy design. You know, you're designed to be in Him. You knew that, right? Your life is actually designed to be drawn from Him. So he's thinking, how can I get that idea across? Bingo, I know. I am the vine and you are the branches. Pretty good. Not bad. But you see, he could have thought, I could unpack that metaphor and I could give him that instead, see? But he didn't. He said, I am the vine and you are the branch. Now, what I've got to assume, what I think we as Christians have to assume, is that that's the best way he could have said it. That's better than any other way. God wouldn't settle for anything short of that, right? So the way he says something and the thing that he's saying are combined together. It's not just what he's telling you, it's how he's telling you. The way that he says something matters. Now, if you accept the premise that the way something is said matters, then I think you'll see what it is I'm talking about for the rest of the talks that I have to give you. Because I'm gonna give you a couple of bits of writing today. I'm gonna read you a couple of bits of writing and talk to you about how it is that form of that writing reflects the meaning of what is being said. Okay? Because I think that's how it is that God actually does it, and we're all kind of imitating Him in our great art. And later I'm gonna talk about music. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about, I forget what I'm talking about tomorrow. It's on the list. I know. I'm going to play you a bit of music and show how the form of the music actually unpacks the meaning of the music in the same way that the reading that we're going to do today unpacks the meaning, okay? I'm going to do it in language today, I'm going to do it in music tomorrow. Okay, that's kind of how we're going to work. And then at the end of the day, tomorrow, I'll sort of pull it all together and talk about aesthetics, which is the study of what's beautiful and why aesthetics is an extremely important subject for Christians to consider today. All right? That's the outline. Everybody okay with that? Do you want me to change anything? Does that feel okay with you? Okay, just check. All right. Very good. Well, I want to read you two bits of writing. One by Shakespeare, and the other by God. And I don't want you to confuse those two, okay? I put them in the reverse significance order, all right? Shakespeare's pretty high up there, but he's no God. But that's the point, kind of the comparison. I want to get the very best that human beings can do and show you what he's doing, and then show you that he's only holding a dim candle to the thing that God actually is doing in this chapter of Job. So we're going to read the first soliloquy from Hamlet. You all know Hamlet? Anybody not read Hamlet? Anybody not know Hamlet? A few of you don't? Okay. All right. Well, it's one of the most famous of Shakespeare's plays. We're going to read that a speech from that, and I'll explain it as we go. And then the second bit we're going to read is just chapter 28 of Job. I'm going to walk you through that, okay? And I'm going to, which hopefully can compare the two. Now, what I've done is I think I've put the text on the screen of my computer here, and if I'm hip, cool, and groovy enough to pull this off, I can show you the text. Let's see. All right, where is it? There we are. Right then, Hamlet, yes. Okay, now, both of these need to be read out loud, so excuse me if I read them out loud to you. That's important. But I want you to see the text as it goes by. Okay, so here's Hamlet. This is Act 1, Scene 2 of Hamlet. He's just come back from school. To his father's funeral. His father's just suddenly died. He's a student in college. He's come back from college to the funeral, and he realizes that his mother has now, bang, married his uncle. Right off the bat, bang, just like that. And he's not very happy about that, and you'll see that in this speech. So what he says after everybody else leaves, and he's on, you know what a soliloquy is, right? A soliloquy is on stage by himself. He's sort of speaking out loud, but he really you're hearing his thoughts in his head. And he says this. He says, Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Or that the everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. Oh God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie on it, ah! Fie, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross possess it merely. That it should come to this, not 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr. Let me not think on it. So loving to my mother that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth must I remember? Why, she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on, and yet, within a month, let me not think on it. Frailty, thy name is woman. A little month! All ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body like Niobe, all tears. Why, she, even she... Oh, God, a beast that wants this course of reason would have mourned longer. Married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month, ere yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left the flushing in her galled eyes, she married. Oh, most wicked speed, to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not nor cannot come to good, but break my heart, for I must hold my tongue. That's his speech. Now, my question to you is, what's the point of the speech? What's he trying to say? What's can you get a general sense of the key point? What is it? What is he concerned about? Yeah? And exactly right. He's so unhappy that his mother married his father's brother, his uncle, so quickly after his father's death, right? Okay, well, let me ask you the question. This is the key question. Why did he write it that way? Why couldn't he have said what you said? Why couldn't he just have Hamlet come on stage and go, I am so ticked off that my mom married my uncle just so quickly after my father's death. Why not? Right? Why not?
For the sake of beauty.
For the sake of beauty. Okay, you're saying this is beautiful. Yeah, right. Me or it? You told it. Yeah. Just wanted to know. There you go. He's trying to get into the head and the heart of the person that's actually doing the speaking, right? Because he puts that point in the speech. Obviously, he says it, right? He finally says, married with my uncle, my father's brother. Boom. There's the line at the end. But it's like 3/4 of the way through the speech. Why does he start the way he does? What's he talking about? What's the too solid flesh? Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. What's the flesh he's talking about? His heart, yes. I wish my heart weren't so cold. Haven't you ever been in a situation where you'd like to be able to say, oh, I'm so happy for you. And you can't do it. You go, oh, man. Mom! Right? So, wait a minute. You remember Dad? I mean, right? So he's not happy. And he says, I wish I could be happy. I wish my cold heart would thaw. Oh, I get it. We get it, right? And he says, or, I wish there was something else that could happen. Or that the everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. Who's the everlasting?
God.
And what's a canon? The law, exactly. God's law says I can't kill myself. That's what it means. I wish my heart were not so hard and cold. I wish it would melt. Or at least I wish God hadn't told me I can't kill myself. That's what that first line means. Now, can you get into his head? Are you in his head now? Heck yeah. Have you ever been depressed? You know what it feels like to look out at the world and it's just dark. Everything seems to be so bleak. Look at that great line. Listen, this is Shakespeare at his best. He says, "How weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world." And then he makes a metaphor. He says, "'Tis an unweeded garden." What are the two things being compared? Exactly. This world and an unweeded garden, they look alike to me. Things rank and gross. What's rank mean? Stinks. Smells bad. Things rank and gross. Gross means overgrown. Big, too big. Overgrown. They're untrimmed. They're uncared for. My wife, here's my wife back here. Say hi to her. Hi. She's a landscape architect, so she knows all about gardens and taking care of, you know, those sorts of things. So, but things in this unweeded garden are rank and gross, and the world looks like that to him. Can you see how he feels? Can you get into his head? And then what does he do? What does he mean when he says that it should come to this, but 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two? My father, 2 months dead. Wait a minute, hasn't even been 2 months yet. Nay, not so much. Not even 2 months. And then what does he compare it to? What does he talk about? He says, so excellent a king, that is my father, that was to this, to my uncle, Hyperion to a satyr. Do you know who Hyperion was? How many of you studied mythology? A few of you? Hyperion was the sun god. He's the guy who would carry the chariot of the sun across the sky. Powerful, noble, strong, bright, brings light to the world. That kind of mythological character, right? Hyperion. My uncle is like a satyr compared to Hyperion, my father. You know what a satyr is, right? Goatman. Yes, a goat man, exactly. Kind of creepy, lust-filled goat, half man that lives in the woods and chases women and all sorts of ugly things as he does. C.S. Lewis put a satyr in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Do you remember Mr. Tumnus? He's a satyr, but Lewis cleaned him up. The old mythological satyr is not somebody you want to hang out with. He's just a revolting creature. But this, and that's the creature that Shakespeare's referring to. My uncle was like Hyperion, my father's like Hyperion. My uncle is like a half man, not even a whole man. Okay, so then he starts talking about how they related to each other. My father loved so loving to my mother that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. What could be more gentle than the winds of heaven? Oh, you winds of heaven, don't blow on my wife's face too hard. That's what he's saying. He protected her, he loved her, he cherished her, he looked after her. He was so good to her, see? And then he tells the other side, he said, and she would hang on him as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. You see all these comparisons? Hyperion to a satyr. All these marvelous metaphorical relations, gardens and world, so loving to my, comparing the love of my mother with not having the winds of heaven hit her too hard, and so on. And then he says, my mother would hang on my father as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on. Now, when you have an appetite and you feed it, what happens to it? It gets smaller, right? It goes away. When I have dinner, I'm hungry when I go in, and I'm not hungry when I go out, right? So my appetite has been slaked, or whatever the right word is. Slaked, is that right? Yeah, okay. Thank you. But her love for him is described as an appetite that seemed to get larger. Her love for him and her appetite for him got larger the more time she spent with him. It couldn't be satisfied. And yet, within a month,
So you get his feelings, right? You get into his head. You get into his heart. You get to see the painting of the situation for him. All of this while he puts off, Shakespeare knowingly puts off the point of this whole thing. He starts off talking about himself. He talks about how he sees the world. He talks about how his parents' relationships were. Then he goes on and talks about... Did I get the next one? Yeah. He talks about how the funeral went. A little month, or ere those shoes that she wore were old with which she followed my poor father's body. Why would she follow his body? How would she? Where would she? In the funeral, right? She followed the casket down the aisle. Ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe, the weeping goddess, all tears, she, even she. Look at that. Look at how it's written. This is an important part. See how he writes those dashes after even she? That's in the original. That's how he wrote it. Look, the line, because of that, it means there's an interjection coming up. There's something coming up that sort of separates the line. So you say, the line would be, why she, comma, even she, married with my uncle, my father's brother. Do you see? That's the line. A little month, or not much time had gone by, she, even she, married with my uncle. That's the point of the speech, right? That's what I'm upset about. But look at this. Shakespeare won't let you have the point of it even now. He puts it off one more couple of lines, and says this interjection. Why she, even she, and then he interrupts himself and just explodes. I can't believe this. Sorry. Why she, even she, oh, God, a beast that wants discourse of reason would have mourned longer. An animal that doesn't have a brain would have mourned for its mate longer than my mother for my father. You see? So, he starts you off this way, and he puts off the point to get you here, puts you off the point to get you here, puts off the point, then he gets to why she, even she, and then puts off the point. See? Then finally, married with my father, my uncle, my father's brother. But, and then he compares him negatively again. But no more like my father than I to Hercules. Another comparison. That's why he wrote it that way. It lays out a beautiful frame so that when you finally do get the point comes home. Far, far, far better. Far, infinitely, nearly better than having him come on stage and go, I'm really ticked off. That just didn't carry any weight, you see. Okay, now, let me check you, change you to Job. This too has to be read, so let's follow along. If you've got your Bibles, you can read along with you, if you can't see the screen. Surely there is a mine for silver, and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust, and copper is smelted from rock. Man puts an end to darkness, and to the farthest limit he searches out the rock. Excuse me, in gloom and deep shadow. He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. They hang and swing to and fro far from men. The earth, from it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as sapphire. Its rocks are the source of sapphire, as fire, I mean. Its rocks are the sources of sapphires, and its dust contains gold. The path no bird of prey knows, nor has the falcon's eye caught sight of it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He, man, puts his hand on the flint and overturns the mountains at the base. He hews out channels through the rocks, and his eye sees anything precious. He dams up the streams from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out to the light. But where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding?
Man does not know its value, nor can it be found in the land of the living. The deep says it's not in me. The sea says it's not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It can't be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned, and the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from, and where is the place of understanding? Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all the living, and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abaddon and Death say, with our ears we have heard a report of it. God understands its way, and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens, when he imparted weight to the wind and meted out the waters by measure. When he set a limit for the rain and a course for the thunderbolt, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Now that's just one solid chapter of Job, straight through. But I want to ask you the same question. What's the key element here? What's the point he's trying to make? What's he talking about? Can you sum it up? The value of wisdom? Yes, okay. What does he say about wisdom? Yeah, but he also tells you what it is, doesn't he? So what did he tell you it is? Fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. That's right. So could you say, it's clearly valuable, you're right. He's certainly saying it's valuable. But wouldn't you say that he's after that particular verse, that last verse that says, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. But you're right, I think you're interested, your initial thought is really good because he's not just telling you specifically what is wisdom, he's telling you how valuable it is. So you're really on the right track. That's kind of the point I'm going to get to. That's very good. So the point of it, though, is the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. Now, why doesn't he write it that way? Just like, why didn't Shakespeare write it the way he did, just to put that one line in Hamlet's mouth? Why doesn't God write Job 28, verse 1? The fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. Job 29. Right? Why not? Well, let's go back and look at it. Why would he start the way he does? There's a mine for silver. What is he talking about? Excellent, excellent, right. Well, and there's a place where silver comes from, there's a place where gold comes from, and eventually in verse 12 he's going to ask, where does wisdom come from? Exactly. But he spends, that's like 5 or 6 or 8 different verses in there that are in between those two points, right? He tells us there's a mine for silver and a place where you find gold. But then he talks about all these other things. What's this? He sinks a shaft far from habitation, forgotten by the foot. Who are they that hang and swing to and fro, far from men? Who are they? Huh? Miners, did you say? Yeah, exactly, the miners. Right, people, right? People are down there looking for all these things. And all the things that they do down there. Look at them all. They sink shafts. They put an end to darkness. They take light into places that are dark. They dig through the rock from the earth. From it comes food. And underneath the earth is turned up as fire. So imagine, we're working ourselves to the bone, turning up the earth and finding sapphires and gold and all those things. And he even says how far we go. Look how far we go. No bird of prey knows where this shaft is. Birds see everything, right? But they don't know where this is. Man digs a lot further down into the ground than any bird ever sees. No bird of prey knows it, and the falcon's eye never saw it. No proud beasts haven't trodden it. You don't see lions and tigers and things down in the mines. They don't want to be down there. They know better. But anyway, man puts his hand on the flint, the rock itself, and turns up mountains. That's how strong we are with our big machines and our shovels and our work. Right? It's amazing what we do. Look at all the ends that we go to come up with gold and silver and sapphires and all this that he lists. So he spends a long time talking about that. Why? Why do you think that's important for him to start there? Well, we should. That's right. But I think that's what he's going to say soon. But why would he tell us all this? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Look at the strength and the energy and the time and the muscle and all that you put into trying to find these things, gold. Now, when you read that, can you put yourself into it, kind of, and think, yeah, boy, that's true. I spend a lot of my time looking into the mines. I think of it metaphorically a little bit, making money. My idea is to spend my life making a living, and as much of a living as I can manage, and working really, really, really hard to get there. So what he's doing here, just like Shakespeare, only better, just like Shakespeare, he's saying, this is where you are. This is where your head is. This is where Hamlet's head is. That's what he was describing to us, right? Well, this is where our head is. People think, how can I make more money? How can I make a decent living? How can I make more than a decent living? We're focused on it. And finally, by verse 12, he says, but where can wisdom be found? Where can wisdom be found? So here I am now, looking down in the tunnels and thinking, how can I get more diamonds and so on? And he says, where can wisdom be found? Well, my first thought is, I know. It's in the mind. All the other important stuff's there, right? So I start looking there. And what does he say? First thing he says, where can wisdom be found? Man doesn't know its value. It's not found in the land of the living. It's not found in the mines, I say. Oh. So I think, okay, well, maybe I can buy it with what I get out of the mines. That's what I'll do, see? And he says, oh, I'm sorry, yeah, I skipped a verse here. 14, he says, the deep says it's not in me, the sea says it's not in me. So here I am looking into the deep, right? I'm looking into the mines, and the mine itself says, not here. And the ocean, the deep depths of the ocean says, not here. Ah, now I'm thinking, I can buy it with what I dig out of the ground, that's what I'll do. And he says, pure gold can't be given in exchange for it. You mean all this wealth that I've acquired? I can't buy wisdom? Then he goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on about it. Look, you can't buy it with gold. You can't buy it with the gold of Ophir, not with onyx, sapphires, gold, and glass. You can't buy it with refined gold. You can't go with coral and crystal. Not even to be mentioned. Don't even talk to me about coral and crystal. You can't buy it with this. You can't buy that. You can't exchange gold for it. You know, coral and topaz of Ethiopia. Imagine how exotic that sounded, right? The topaz of Ethiopia? Holy cow! I can't get it with the topaz of Ethiopia. What am I going to get it with? If I can't do that, it's like, man, that's it. That's fantastic. So I can't value wisdom in pure gold. So here I've been. You see how it changes my heart? It's starting to ask new things inside of me. I was looking at this and I wasn't even asking questions. He says, what about wisdom? I go, well, I'll get it out of the ground. He goes, nope. I'll pay for it out of the ground. He goes, nope. So now I'm not so interested in the ground anymore. See? He's changed my mind. He's changed my heart. Okay. So where can wisdom be found? He says. Where then? See the then there? It's different than verse 12. Where can wisdom be found? Verse 20. Where then does wisdom come from? Okay. Can you hear the resignation a little bit? Okay. Where does wisdom come from? So now taking my eyes off of this, I've taken my eyes off of the idea that I can get it with this. Now I realize this is really not going to help me at all. But I want wisdom now. He's started this hunger in me for wisdom. So I want to know what it is. Why now doesn't he say, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom? Do you know why? Because I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready to hear it yet. Look what he does do.
Where then does wisdom come from? Where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Hold it. You mean I can't call up my brother Chuck and ask him? I can't go to my rabbi? I can't go to my pastor? You know, well, I guess that's not exactly what he's talking about here. Certainly can't get wisdom there. But it's not wisdom that comes from them. It's wisdom that comes through them from God, right? So I can't just go to people. The whole world, the eyes of the living, don't get it on their own. Death itself isn't an answer. Do you see that? With our ears, we have heard a report of it. Death has only heard a report of wisdom, not the real thing. Okay, now I'm going, this sounds bad. How do I get wisdom? Okay, see, I was looking this way without even asking the question. Now he's worked me all the way around so that I'm now looking this way at wisdom. Hey, what? Wisdom? How do I get it? He says, God understands its way. Why didn't I think of that? Okay, now I say, God? What's wisdom? I can't get it from my friends. I can't get it from anybody living. I can't get it from the birds of the sky. I can't even get it from dying. Dying isn't going to reveal it to me. I only have you to turn to now. See how he's whittled me down? He's weaned me from the false purpose, and he's gotten me to the real purpose, and now he's telling me that God is the one who has the wisdom. Only God. So now I'm begging God, and I'm saying, God, tell me what wisdom is. See how he's changed my heart? Okay, now, why doesn't he, in verse 24, why doesn't he write, Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom? This is the coolest part of this of all. If you didn't get anything so far, this is absolute. Did I say hip, cool, and groovy before? That's what this is. This is unbelievable. Check this out. This is the supernatural working of the Holy Spirit. Not only has he changed my heart a little bit already, so that I'm turning my back on what I used to be doing, see the futility of that, and I want wisdom. He says, God is the only one who can get wisdom for me. And I say, okay, well, give me wisdom. And he says, no. Why? Because you're not ready yet. That's why. What do I need to know now? What is it I need to do or know before I can get this wisdom? I need to know about God. That's what he tells me about. For he, God, looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. He's completely omnipotent. He imparted weight to the wind. Now, who does that? That's awesome, right? He is the one who says how strongly the winds are going to blow. He is the guy who shows where the limits of the waters are going to be. The ocean can come this far and no further. He metes out the waters by measure. He tells you how much rain is going to come. This is the God we serve. This is the one. He created the world. He's completely omnipotent. He's the guy who sets the course for the thunderbolt. This is a powerful, huge God. And now, check this out. This is the coolest part. Now I'm not just turning to God as the only source for wisdom. I'm turning to God in awe. My heart now, taking all these descriptions of God into my soul, to my heart, I now recognize that He is truly astonishingly big and powerful, and I am in awe of Him, okay? Now, I'm on my knees before this God, and I'm saying, please, tell me what wisdom is. Now you pull the trigger. Now I'm ready. But this is the part that's so cool. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. That's what it says, right? What does the fear of the Lord mean? How do you hear that? Does that mean, oh God, I'm so afraid? Is that what it means? Some people interpret it that way. I don't think so. How would you describe it? What's the fear of the Lord? Reverence. Good, that's good. Yes, reverence. Awe. That's, I think, the best word of all. We toss that word around, awesome, oh, that's awesome. But really, it's really appropriate for God. He is truly awe-inspiring, awesome, awful. That's what awful means, you know. So look at the marvel of this. Look what the Spirit has done through the work of this Word. He's taken me from the point of not paying any attention to wisdom, really, only to my own riches. He's moved me around so that I think about how I can get that wisdom, but I can't buy it with what I've dug out of the ground. I now realize that I can't get that wisdom from anybody but God. There's nobody to get it from but God. And God is the most awesome thing you've ever even contemplated. And I'm on my knees before God. Listen to this. I am in the position of the fear of the Lord. Do you see it? Now that I'm on my knees, I am actually participating in the fear of the Lord before He says to me, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. You see the position you're in right now? Yes? That's what wisdom is. That is the genius of the Scripture. Do you see how the form of this poetry, the form of this chapter, actually helped me change spiritually? This is the living Word of God. Shakespeare could only hope to come close to that in any of his speeches. But do you see how both Shakespeare and God put off the punchline? The point of the speech is way the heck down there. So what I want to end with is two things. In order to be able to read the Scriptures properly, in order to properly understand art, literature, film, visual art, architecture, music, theater, any of those things that you can think of, photography, in order to be able to understand the Scriptures and to be able to understand and unpack the arts, you need two things. You need an imagination, and you need patience. You need an imagination because it's the imagination that's the organ in you that makes it possible for you to see the relationships of the two parts of a metaphor. If somebody were to go out to a grizzly bear and say, Juliet is the sun, the grizzly bear would just eat you. He would not say, wow, that's good. I'm not going to eat you. Animals don't have this gift. This is a gift from God. The imagination is a gift from God. A lot of people are concerned, a lot of Christians often are concerned about use of the imagination or thinking about the imagination because it may lead you in the wrong direction for you to imagine things that are not true. Okay? But that's not its purpose. It's true, you can misuse your imagination. But what the imagination is for is so that you can see the correlation between two things that you might not have noticed before. Have you ever Ken Myers? Anybody ever run into Ken Myers? Yeah? Well, Ken Myers is a buddy of mine, and he said one time in a speech that the imagination is not so much to invent new things, but to see the relationships between things that you see out there. So, for example, here you are reading Ephesians 5, and it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Wives, submit to your husbands as unto the Lord. And suddenly it dawns on you that it doesn't have anything to do with husbands and wives. It has to do, this is a description of the church and Jesus. That's what it's a description of, you see? And well, it has something to do with husbands and wives, only insofar as that they then are a physical relationship in this world that makes some invisible relationship possible, or to be seen, do you see? We're taking up roles in marriage in order that we and others can see the relationship between Christ and the church, because that's invisible, right? You can't see him, you can't see the church in its entirety. But if you see a healthy marriage, it's an imitation of that relationship, you see? And it's your imagination that can grasp that. So you need your imagination to be able to unpack these metaphors unpack these relationships, unpack the profundity and the extra dimensions of all these words. To be able to put yourself into this situation like I just did, you know, think myself, here I am, I'm experiencing what people are experiencing, and if I allow the peace to talk to me as it comes, then I'll be able to get the point of it. So I need an imagination. Oh, I got some jumping ahead of myself. Because the other thing you need is patience. Right? You need an imagination to unpack the relationships of things so that you can see invisible things through visible things. But you need you need patience because you need to be able to allow the peace, whether it's Job 28 or the scriptures itself, or any other artwork, you need to be able to allow it to speak to you in its tempo. Now, if you're like me, when I've read Job 28 many times before I actually came to the kind of read that I've just given you, and when I read it, I would kind of go, fear the Lord, oh, got it, fear the Lord, that's wisdom, Job 29, see what I mean? I just kind of rushed through it. But you see what happens when you rush through it is you get, you know, like Hamlet coming on and going, and walking off. What good is that? You see, God meant it to be read this way. So you have to be willing to accept it His way. You see? Now, I would argue that that's how you should treat any bit of artwork. It's just a kind of respect to the author. Okay? So you let it speak to you. That doesn't mean you believe it, mind you. Understand, we take this as the Word of God. That's a different thing. It's in a different category. But when I look at a painting by Georges Rouault or Monet or somebody, or a piece of music or something, I'm listening to the creative work of a human being. It's not God. However, the human being needs to be able to speak to me in his own way, in his own tempo. If I require that he take up my tempo, if I start forcing it into my little squares and boxes, I don't get to grow from it. I don't learn from it. I don't get anything out of it. But maybe a momentary flash. So you need to be patient. You need to let a piece of work speak to you in its own tempo. You see? The story goes that T.S. Eliot, to illustrate this point, wrote, you know, many poems. If you've read any, have you read, anybody read Eliot? Oh, good. What have you read? Which one? Wasteland, yeah. Has anybody read Wasteland? Is that big? Yeah. Have you read the Four Quartets? Anybody read the Quartets? Drop everything. Goodness. It's thick waiting, but it's really, really wonderful. I'll just give you 2 seconds of background. Eliot, you know, became a Christian toward the end of his life. Did you know that? Eliot was not a believer when he wrote The Wasteland. But when he wrote The Wasteland, he was asking all the right questions. So read The Wasteland. It's a tremendously powerful piece of work about the fragmentation of what they call the entre-deux-guerres, the time between two wars, the time between the First World War and the Second World War. A lot of disillusionment. And Eliot was able to capture that in The Wasteland and other poems. But not too long after that, he became a Christian, and about 20 years after that, he finished the Four Quartets during the Second World War. And the Four Quartets are the answers to all those questions that came up in The Wasteland. So if you don't know them, time to do it. But here's what I was going to say about him. The story goes, whether it's apocryphal or not, I don't know, but it's a worthy parable anyway. The story goes that Eliot came and read some of his poetry at a poetry reading, you know. And afterwards, somebody said, hey, Tom, can you tell us what that poem means? And I wish I could be this sharp. I wish I could be this quick. But what he said back was, you mean you want me to say it worse? Think about it. I crafted every syllable of that poem to say what I was trying to say the best way I possibly could. You see? That is what I'm trying to say. Right there. That's it. If I boil it down, if I say it in another way, I'm saying it in a worse way. The story goes that Beethoven was played a concert at the piano, played one of his sonatas, and after he finished, someone said, what does this
music mean? Tell me what it means. And he thought about it and thought about it, and then he just sat down and played the whole thing again. Because that's the way to say it. Do you see? That's what's trying to be said. So, in order to understand, you have to be willing to let it speak to you in its way. And I think that's just respect for the author or the composer and so on. Okay. What I want to do tomorrow is I remembered now what I was going to do. The music one I told you about, and the final one about the wrap-up. But I've got something in the morning that's really cool, too. I'm going to talk to you about how to read a window that is a stained glass window. It's a window in a very old cathedral called Chartres Cathedral. Have you seen Chartres? Anybody been to Chartres? Some of you been to Chartres? Super, super. Well, this is the Good Samaritan window from Chartres Cathedral. And I thought we'd teach you how to read them, because it's a little way to do that, and then show you why it is that the window was put together the way it was. All of these things that I'm going to be doing with you, I hope, are going to be these sorts of artistic unpacking to see what it is and how it is that a Christian can understand how to read, look, hear, and so on, and engage with the culture, because the culture is full of art, and that art is speaking to us in languages. Any questions I could answer quick before we quit? I've got about 2 minutes. Any questions? What do you think? That's right. Yes, sir. My favorite style of music? The reason I'm hesitating is only that I don't know what you mean by style. what would you mean by style? Okay, okay. So a particular historical period? A stylistic period? I'm with you. Because sometimes people say, you know, do you like reggae or rap or, you know, that's a style too, right? So maybe it is. I'm a little weird this way. I think of music as human expression. I think it's like a language. And so different languages have different dialects and different, you know, even different words. And different dialects and different languages can speak about a certain human experience or whatever better than others. And so I don't know that I like a particular composer or a particular style, that is, a historical period, more than another. So I guess I can't answer it, but I'm glad you know what you mean by style. A lot of times that's too narrow a category. There is popular music today that's well written. There's a lot of it that's extremely badly written. But there's Baroque music that's extremely badly written too, see. So it's not like all of it is good back then and it's all bad now, or the reverse. So it's a matter of looking at and listening to a particular period's music in the language that it is, and recognizing the genius of someone using that particular language to say something great. I'll play you some music tomorrow, and we'll talk about it. Any other questions? All right, you've been very brave to sit through this. I'll see you tonight.